But what do we do with the living, the existing, with our fellow people? You know, I'd like to think today that for me, it would not have been possible to have been here without Alcoholics Anonymous. Because you people nurtured me back into society. You people helped me. You gave me support when there was none. There was no financial contributions to my welfare. Today I'm self-supporting, and I have been since my release. But you told me this, that it'd get better. Last Wednesday I celebrated 11 years of sobriety. And you know, I can only tell you that it has got better each and every time. And each and every day. The years are not important to me as it is the days. I live a program of one day at a time. I never know what each day is going to unfold. But you know, with the tools, the equipment, and a loving God, in a word that a lot of people don't like to hear, a sponsor, I've been able to make it. I've been hard on sponsors, and I've been equally hard on God. For him, the recreation has been quite easy, but the regeneration has been terrible. And it's been hard. But I tell you, the life that I lived prior to Alcoholics Anonymous was not beautiful either. And you people have helped me turn it around. And with his help, I'm going in the direction he would have us to go. You know, I often think of where it tells us in the big book, and I hate to be a big book thumper, but I believe in it. Our only purpose is to be of maximum service to God and help others. And I try to live by that. And by living by that, I've gotten to know you and love you. And for this alcoholic, that was nearly impossible. When you love yourself, you can't love others. I'd like to read the preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve the common problem to help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any causes. Where'd I lose? Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses or opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. That is probably the first thing I found out when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the reasons I was in trouble all the time is I couldn't see. I used to think I'd sing real good when I was drunk. But the first thing I found out in recovery is I was partially blind, you know. I appreciated that for many years because it gave me an excuse for some of the mistakes I made. I've asked a lady, Vicky, to come up and read how it worked from chapter 5 of the big book.
Good morning. My name is Vicky. I'm an alcoholic and drug addict.
Hi, Vicky.
For me, for 16 years, people kept bringing the message to prison to show us or share how it worked for them. And for 16 years, I could not grasp and develop a manner of living that required rigorous honesty. I'd like to thank the people present and those that aren't, you know, that brought the message for many years. And so far I have seen one. I'm sure there's others. Martha W., Karen, and Bill and Dee, and many others that I can't think of their names right now. But nearly 7 years ago, I hit my bottom, and that's what it took for me to begin to learn how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose, in a general way, what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his help, his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order. I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is, we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if he were sought. Thank you.
I've also asked the Northern Area Supervisor of Texas Department of Corrections, the Alcoholism and Drug Program, to say a few words about what DDC is doing. Bob?
My name is Bob, recovering alcoholic addict. The program in TDC and this fellowship is going on its 39th year. We have a population of over 38,000 people, human beings, men and women in the population. Over 30,000 of them will be released this year, and over 30,000 will be entering the department. Over 80% of them are there, directly or indirectly, because of their involvement with alcohol and other drugs. We heard about the miracles that Bob spoke about last night, that Susan and Mary spoke about yesterday, the old-timers the night before. I didn't go to this program when I had all my hair and I was a bit younger. This program came to me. And there was a man in a big black robe sitting behind a podium elevated above me that said, young man, you're on probation. You either are going to respond to the efforts of this program, or we're going to do something else with you. Not everyone in the department goes to the meetings for the right reasons, but they go. I didn't go to this program when I first went for the right reasons. I cannot go to a meeting, any large meeting particularly, or any group throughout this state, without having someone come up to me and say, my name is so-and-so, and as soon as they find out where I'm from, my number was. I'd like to introduce you to my wife, to my husband. These are my children. The program taught me, while I was inside, a freedom. But since I've been out, it's taught me how to live. And Richard addressed that. We have miracles throughout this state, and we have miracles inside. We have people here, some of them, Don A. and so on, that have been visiting over 30 years, our institutions. Martha, Alverna, Bob and Betty S. Hundreds, literally hundreds of human beings carrying the message. It's so very important, and you're going to hear that this morning. We can't keep it unless we're willing to give it away. Bill didn't wait for Dr. Bob to come to him. And Dr. Bob and Bill didn't wait for that man on the bedside to come to them. This program reaches out and carries the message. TDC is gratified. The administration and the program is gratified to have a group, thousands of loving human beings, share this program, their experience and strength and hope with our population. It is very important. Thank you.
Without any more of my 369, we'll get right into the what is important. And I know it is important because I've had the privilege of doing this as an inmate. And you know, the thing that always got me was this. You people accepted us as human beings, which is what we all are. Some of us have doubts of that before we get to this program. I've seen and had the misfortune, however you want to put it, of seeing people truly waste their lives because of a failure in life. You know, helping inmates, to me, is easy. But it's not that way for everybody. And one of the things that happens when you help inmates is you really become exposed to life. A thing I can share with you, it's not easy on me, but it's a fact of life. And I had to accept what you told me in this program, that I couldn't change people. I worked with a man who I knew in the prison system. He'd got out. He'd gone back twice on a life sentence. And the last time I worked with him, he got the cure for alcoholism. He ate a shotgun. And his greatest wish was, I don't want to drink, but I've got to, because I'm afraid. It's the only thing that removes the idea that I can return to penitentiary again. And we all know that fear won't do anything for you. And he never could beat it. It's my hope today that he's not afraid. But I learned a lot from that. And he was a typical good drunk. He used the geographic cure as often as he could, and he called me from Florida, and he called me from California, and he called me from all over the United States. But each time it was this: "It's killing me." And I said, "What?" And he said, "The fact that I know there's a way out, and I can no longer use it." And I think that's basically what Bob was saying last night. You can get to that stage. If you sit around day after day thinking about your problems, that's all you've got is problems. I choose to believe that most of us in Alcoholics Anonymous, and speaking solely for the only one I know, myself, I quit having problems several years ago. But boy, I've got a sack full of challenges. And that's the way that it works for me. The God that I know is bigger than any problem that I could arise within me. And if I just can remember, when all else fails, all the great reasoning of mine, that God's bigger than the problem. And I'm not. I never have been, nor will I ever be. And it's that simple. When I think of all the people that have gone before and how they have told us that it's just a spiritual program, and here some 11 years later, for myself, I've got a little spiritual. How spiritual, I don't know. Some days I feel like I could probably walk on water, and other days I'd drown. And I think the program is meant to be that way. I don't think that for me it's never been even keeled. Every time that I get the hook on things, along come one of these challenges. Today, the only thing that I know that I didn't know when I came here is that I don't have to stay in the challenge as long as I wanted to, you know. There's relief. And it's not instant. It may be pray today and the answer 4 weeks from now. But the answer always comes. Both of these people who are here on this dais this evening, or this morning, have known what it is to have challenges. And when you have a lot of time with yourself, you either succumb to these things or you ask God to remove them. But rather than me tell their story, I'd like theirs too. And I'd like, first of all, I'd like Dorothy to introduce Cynthia. Dorothy.
Good morning. I am Dorothy, and I'm an Al-Anon. On our unit, which is the Mountain View unit of TDC, I'm known as Mrs. Martin, and I'm an alcohol and drug counselor. The person I bring to you today is also a member of AA. And we are here today representing our AA group, which is the Mountain Viewers. I just want to thank each of you for showing up today, because your presence tells us that you are aware and are supporting our men and women behind the walls in white, who are trying to work a program in the most difficult situations that you can imagine. And the woman I'm bringing to you today was not unaware of the program when she came into TDC. It helped her tremendously, the background that she had before she got there. But when she came in, I did not get a note from classification saying, "This is Cynthia B, and she doesn't want the program," with an exclamation point behind it. That's what I get from many, many women. Her name was Cynthia B., and she wants the program. And that's the way she has been living her program in her life while she has been incarcerated. And I want to give you Cynthia B. Make her welcome, please.
Thank you. I am Cynthia, and I'm an alcoholic. I just want to thank you for being here. I want to thank the state committee. Our room is lovely. It's just wonderful. The hotel has just been great, and mostly all of you have been wonderful. I have felt so much support and love. I was concerned about that, and I felt so at home and so accepted, and I thank you for showing me that that part of the program works this weekend. Because I believe that my alcoholism and the traits of that include started a long time before I took my first drink, I want to tell you a little bit about what my childhood was like. One of the first memories that I have, and I don't know how old I was that every afternoon I got a bath and I got my hair fixed and I got ribbons in my hair, and my job was to entertain my dad when he came home from work. That meant keep him happy, and that meant keep him calm while Mother got dinner. One of the things I think I learned from that was that I had a lot of control when it worked. And one of the other things that happened is that it didn't work a lot. And I learned to blame myself. You know, it was supposed to be my job. And I kept trying, and I didn't think I was doing a very good job of making him happy and controlling the family. I had a brother that was 2 years younger than me. And we didn't live in a home with alcoholism. My father's mind-changing chemical came in the form of pills, and he was chronically ill. There was a lot of rage and anger and hostility. The way that I learned to respond to that when I couldn't control it was to hide. My favorite hiding place was a little dark closet that was in my room. And my brother and I would both hide in there together. We rescued each other a lot and tried to take care of each other the best that we could. Some of the time we couldn't take care of each other very well. And that led to a lot of feelings of failure. You know, the control wasn't working, and sometimes even the hiding wasn't working. One of the ways that I could succeed was at school. I could go to school and look real good and pretend that everything was all right at home, because we certainly didn't talk about things, and we didn't have any feelings that we could share. So I could go to school. And at school, everything was fine. You know, I pretended that we had a perfect little home, and perfect family, and that we loved each other, and that was a wonderful way to live. You know, for a few hours a day, I could escape, and that escape felt really good to me. I was probably about 15 when I discovered that alcohol gave me that same escape. It was in the back seat of a red Corvair, and I got drunk on Southern Comfort and Coke, and from then on, that's exactly what I did when I drank. That was get drunk. I had found two ways that I could escape. I could go to school during the day and do well and look fine, and I could get drunk at night. And all of a sudden, I didn't have to face those angry, rageful feelings anymore. I didn't have to admit that I was hurt. I didn't have to admit that I was afraid. I could just drink when I wanted to and when I could. When I graduated from high school, I was lucky enough to get a scholarship to Houston Baptist College. It was a debate scholarship, and it had become very difficult to keep up the facade of being a really nice person when I was getting drunk. People were starting to find out. So I had to set up two sets of friends. The ones that I drank with, they didn't live in our part of town, and they didn't go to school with me, because they might tell. And that set up a real pattern that lasted for about 15 years, having two sets of friends and two real separate lifestyles. Nice young girls who go to Baptist colleges do not get drunk on a regular basis and stay in Baptist colleges. So I learned to try to manipulate situations, and I had so many secrets. You know, lying in my life had started a long time before the drinking started. It had gotten to the point Well, I'm not sure I knew the difference in the truth and a lie, and if I did, I was going to choose to tell the lie. But it was real hard to remember what all those lies were. Sometimes I got very confused. I set myself up again and again to get caught in difficult and hard kinds of situations. My answer was to drink again, you know. I didn't have to feel responsible. I didn't have to feel like I had a conscience if I drank. One of the things that also happened in college was the use of a lot of other chemicals, mostly amphetamines, that continued for a long time after that. By the time I got to college, I had also changed, and I decided I could only drink gin. And that was my drug of choice then for several years after that. When I finished college, it was real important to keep up the facade of the person I was pretending to be. I did not want people who were important in my life to know what I was really like. And so I worked very hard on that facade. I married a man who I thought was going to be just perfect, and I stayed married to that same man for the next 12 years. We went to graduate school at Texas A&M University, and I finished a master's degree in education and started teaching school. Now, here I am doing exactly the same thing again. Drinking is okay in our home as long as Cynthia doesn't stay drunk. So I had to keep a lot of my drinking a secret from even my husband. And I still had to set up, every time we moved, a different set of friends that I could do the things that I wanted to do with, and a set of friends that were socially acceptable. I don't know why that pretense was so important to me. I think it was because if I told you who I was, you weren't going to accept me. If I told you what I did and how I felt, you know, when Richard said you feel like you're not a human being and you're not worth it, I didn't feel like I could succeed or that I'd have a friend in the world if you really knew what I was like. So I kept up a facade. I pretended I was worse with one set of friends than I thought I was, and I pretended I was a whole lot better with another set of friends than I really thought I was. When I started teaching, it became even more difficult to hide my alcoholism. You don't usually teach first graders drunk, you know. They know. It's real more difficult, I think, to hide from six-year-olds and five-year-olds than it is to hide from adults. Well, I came up with the right answer for that, I thought, real quick. I decided I'd teach college English, and I went out real quick and got me a job to do that. It was real easy then to stand behind a podium and hide. You didn't have to have close contact. You'll notice that hiding, for me, was very important. It was real important to protect and to keep that wall up so that no one could know me. I guess I had a typical kind of life. My husband worked for a major oil company and designed and fabricated oil field equipment. And we had both grown up on farms. One of the things that happened was back in the 70s is that he became very successful very fast. And all of a sudden we had a lot of money, more money than I'd ever thought about having. You know, I went to work teaching school for $5,000 a year, and 2 years later he made over $100,000, and we spent every single penny, more than every single penny, living in the fast lane and traveling and mostly drinking. I don't know whether Harold's an alcoholic. I know he didn't drink as much as I did, and I know we used to fight a lot about what he called my alcoholism. At that point, I was not willing to say I was an alcoholic at all. I used to prove that I wouldn't have to drink, and that'd last maybe an hour. One of the things that One of the miracles of my life is that I have three children. I'd like to tell you about them. I have two boys, Matthew and Adam. And I have a little girl who we adopted, whose name is Jenny. And I haven't seen them in over 4 years. And I don't really know how they are today because I don't hear from them. But I think they're real special. When I had Matthew and Adam, I was drinking on a regular basis. God must have saved them from fetal alcohol syndrome because they were born normal and healthy and intelligent and bright. When we adopted Jenny, she had a lot of physical problems. And that was in 1981. And by that time, I had become so dependent on chemicals that I don't know why I ever thought I could be a mother to another child. You know, I guess I thought I had done a real good job. I had breastfed both the boys. I now know that the reason that when they were weaned, they both ended up in the hospital is because they were addicted to alcohol and amphetamines. And when they stopped nursing, they ended up in the hospital. Then I thought they just liked nursing, you know. Jenny had a lot of physical problems, and shortly after we got her, and that was a real miracle that I thought that she came into our lives, she was hospitalized. And we were living in Lubbock at the time, and she was sent to Texas Children's in Houston. You know, I'm not real clear, and I don't know what my purpose and reason was for staying with Jenny in the hospital. I don't know if I felt like some of the things that I had done in my life at that point were going to be vindicated if I was a real good mother and stayed in the hospital and took care of her. I really think that what I wanted to do was hide again. Things had gotten pretty tough at home. I was overspending and running around, and we were getting these bills that I didn't know where they came from. You know, hotel. We were living in Lubbock, and we'd get these hotel bills from Dallas and Houston, and I had signed the ticket, and, you know, that was not acceptable. All of a sudden, some of the things that I was doing were being found out, and Jenny came at a time that by leaving, I avoided a lot of conflict in my family. So I left two little boys in Lubbock being cared for by a housekeeper, and I left a husband, and I went to Houston. And that hospitalization ended up lasting for a year and a half. What happened during that hospitalization was real important for me and for finding recovery. I drank every day. I had a child that stayed in intensive care, and I stayed passed out. I can't tell you that I did a real good job of caring for her. There were times when Jenny had four pumps hooked up to her and blood transfusions going, and I was drunk. By being friends with the chief of staff at the hospital, I got to keep the gin in my room, and I was supplied with other chemicals that I wanted to have. One of the real miracles that happened when I didn't even believe that there was a God was that Jenny got better. And after a year and a half in the hospital, we went home to Lubbock. All those problems that I left were all still there when I got home. Jenny started getting better, and I got worse. You know, my alcoholism at that point was full-blown. I couldn't get up in the morning without a drink. I remember saying, today I'm not going to do that. I don't have to do that. And I couldn't, you know. I still had a lot of responsibilities. I had a huge calendar, and if that was my brain, because mine was wet, I certainly didn't have one that was functioning. And if what I needed to do that day was written on the calendar, that got done. I'm not sure how. My children at that point were so overly organized, and our social life was so organized that I could manage to hide from myself that way. I could get up early in the morning and drink enough so that I passed out that night. Sometimes I'd wake up in the middle of the night and have to drink. That's a real horrible feeling. that I remember, having those shakes. One of the things that happened in my alcoholism is that I don't have a conscience anymore while I'm using. As a woman, I never learned to be angry. An acceptable emotion was fear. You know, I know now that the Big Book tells me fear sets in motion a train of circumstances that we think we don't deserve. My train of circumstances, you know, I think I deserve because I've become responsible for them. I did a lot of things that I wanted to keep a secret. You know, when I was getting in trouble with my husband, I'd do things to set up a crisis. I burned down a house. I was spending a lot more than Harold made. And it's expensive to keep up the lifestyle I thought I wanted to be accustomed to. So, he took away the money, Susan. I had an answer to that. I knew that he had good credit at Texas Commerce Bank, so I went and signed his name on a loan of about $37,000. I still don't know what I did with all that money. And he just kept paying the bills and taking care of me and raising hell at home. I think he knew who burned our house. I don't know that. But I think he probably knew. So did a lot of other people, probably. Sometimes I want to say that my addiction cost us a lot of money. That's not really true. One of the things I do when I drink is shop and spend money. And use the telephone. And get on airplanes. They haven't taken me to the airport this weekend, but I think it might be okay, sober. You know. All of a sudden, I'd lost the ability to hide what was going on. A lot of people that I knew were very aware of my addiction. They were very aware of my alcoholism. They were very aware of my crazy behavior. I could not pretend to be sweet little person very much longer. I was feeling really, really trapped. The neighbors knew how I was acting. The bank knew. Friends knew. For some reason, it was okay that I stayed drunk at home for me because there was someone else living in our house that took care of our children. But I was certainly able to talk about a couple of other mothers who drank too much and didn't take care of theirs. I'm not sure how I made that all right for me, but I did. By the fall of 1983, life was just pretty damn miserable. I spent a lot of time traveling back and forth to my parents' house. One of the things I've come to learn is that I'm very codependent with my father, who I thought I hated and didn't ever want to see. But yet I kept going home over and over and over, not to live, but on almost a weekly basis in the fall of 1983. I went home to Madisonville. And I was just real hooked into a very abusive situation. The other thing I could do was hide there, and I couldn't hide in Lubbock anymore. Harold was on to me. He knew what was going on. Um, One of the times that I was in Madisonville in September, I was real desperate for some money, and I stole some checks from my grandmother and wrote them. You know, most people can write checks for $30 or $40. I have to write them for $2,000 and $3,000. And, you know, people are going to know that. And when my parents called me to ask me about it, my grandmother had called them, and I said, well, she sent me those checks. You know, she's old, and she just doesn't remember. But I'll come and we'll talk to her about it. One of the other things that was going on at that time was that I was absolutely and totally convinced that our daughter's natural mother wanted her back. And I lived with a lot of fear about that. I really felt like since other people were starting to find out about these crazy, horrible things that I was doing in the midst of my alcoholism, that she was going to get her back, you know, that... The judge who said that we could have her was going to change his mind if he knew what kind of mother she had. And too many people were starting to know what I was like. And somehow, in my little warped brain, I also decided that my parents were helping her. So in October of 1983, on a weekend, I went to Madisonville. I was going to tell my grandmother how wrong she was because she had sent the money. And I was going to tell my parents that they couldn't get Jenny away from me. And what happened was by the time I flew into Love Field and rented a car and drove into Madisonville, and by the time I got there, I was, you know, stinking drunk. And that's the first time that my parents became aware of one of the symptoms of my disease, and that was my usage. What happened was my mother called my husband, who said he'd come and get me, and they'd decide what they were going to do with me the next day. And my father took my car keys, which set off an argument. Daddy's rage is something I usually ran from. And for some reason, on this day, I didn't run from it anymore. You know, I was going to get the car keys, and I was going to leave. And we got into an argument, and that turned into a fight. And all of a sudden, all that anger that I'd been sitting on for years and years and would never let out, ever let show, because good little girls did not get angry, came out. And on October 23rd, 1983, I shot 11 shots at my parents. I'm real lucky that they're okay. I understand that they're healthy today. Physically healthy today. I don't have a reason for the shooting, you know. I can tell you that that I was drunk, and that for the first time in my life I could identify a feeling of being very angry. And it really wasn't at anything that happened that weekend or that week. And I was also stopping a situation. I didn't want anybody else to find out what I was really like. That controlled me. In totality, that controlled me. What happened was I put on a real act, you know. I told the sheriff that somebody must have come in that house and done that. And then I told him that I saw who came in and did that, that he had on light-colored clothes. I've just recently been allowed to go outside the gate and work and at TDC on a regular basis. And I've been allowed to see the dogs and horses, and I remember that morning a whole bunch of dogs and horses from Texas Department of Corrections showing up there on Mother and Daddy's farm. I thought, isn't that nice? They're going to help them find this person. You know, I had already said they had on light clothes. It makes sense to me now. They thought it was somebody like me today, an inmate, and that's what they were looking for. It wasn't. You know, it wasn't. When my parents were able to tell them that evening what had happened, I was arrested. And I was put in a drunk tank in a little bitty county jail. And it was dark. And there wasn't a bed. And it was very dirty. And I was still playing my act. You know, I wasn't even going to sit down. I had on wool pants and a cashmere sweater and all my jewelry, and I was going to just stand there for a little while and somebody would realize the error of their ways and come and get me. They didn't do that. You know, I called my husband, who didn't come till the next day. By then I was in withdrawal. I didn't make the decision to sit down. I found myself on the floor shaking and sweating and vomiting in that same little hole that I thought was so dirty. And I saw things dancing on the walls. I think that withdrawal for me was tough. I had never, in a lot of years, remember my body without alcohol. And I was very miserable. By the time the next afternoon came, typically, I think that sheriff's department and judge decided that I must just be crazy, because I wouldn't do what I did if I'd known what I was doing. So they brought me out of my cell with an attorney present and told me that if I wouldn't go to psychiatric hospital, they'd let me. They had set a bond the night before to keep me there for about $300,000. The next day, they let me sign myself out of that county jail and go to a psychiatric hospital. Somewhere, God had to have been beginning to work in my life, even though at that point I knew there was not a God that could work miracles. Because when I got to that hospital, I was able to say, I drink too much. Now, I had been to psychiatrists before. One of Harold's answers to my problems at home with money and fires and other things was to take me to a psychiatrist. What I found out was that was just one more doctor that could feed my pill addiction if I didn't tell him about my alcoholism. I was able to say to this doctor, I have a problem. I drink too much, and I've been taking too many pills. And I'm not going to do that anymore. I still thought that I could just not do it. And that kind psychiatrist said, Cynthia, with all the things that you've been through, because I could always tell him about how hard being in the hospital was with Jenny and how terrible Harold was and all the pressure of my life. I'm going to give you this shot, and we'll talk about your other ideas in the morning. That's all I needed. You know, the next morning we didn't talk about my other ideas about not using anything. I was willing to take what the nurse brought into the room. I spent about 4 weeks heavily sedated. But I have to tell you about some things that went on. I was in Houston at Bel Air General Hospital at a Genesis treatment program, and that went on the psych floor. Those people, brand new, sober people, just trying to find out what the program was about, ate dinner with me, ate breakfast with me, invited me to see the videos that they had, that Father Martin's Chalk Talk. And listen to some big book study tapes. One of them gave me a big book and a 12 and 12 and a 24 hour a day. And they said, we don't know what's the matter with you. But maybe you have a problem with alcohol or pills. They kind of knew I must have had a problem with pills. Harold had brought about 2,000 pills to the hospital so they could decide what all I'd been taking. It was real easy for them to know I'd been drinking gin. The car was full of empty gin bottles. Those people loved me. While I was sedated and while I was still crazy, I thought I had a real good defense to avoid coming to prison. I could just be crazy. But something happened. On December 5th, 1983, I made the decision against medical advice to not take anything. I had not drank since October 23rd, and I decided that day that there was a better way. You see, I knew I couldn't do it on my own, but there were these people who drank like I drank who weren't drinking anymore, and they weren't taking anything in its place. Something was working for them, and somehow by osmosis and by their sharing, I was able to find out about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew that a miracle could take place. When I had originally gotten to the hospital, they hooked me up to IVs, and they gave me orange juice, and they took care of me. And when I withdrew against medical advice from sedatives, it was horrible. I stole rubber gloves to put ice on my head. You know, I didn't get a lot of help and sympathy at that point. A real blessing came into my life. I had a judge who, I don't know how, but I called him on the telephone, and he answered the phone. Said, you've got me in the psychiatric hospital, and that's not my problem. Now, I'm sedated, but I understand that for the first time in my life that I can remember, I'm going to tell somebody that I'm responsible. And, you know, I told the judge that I was guilty and that I didn't think I was crazy, but that I was an alcoholic, and that there was a treatment program at that hospital that I wanted to go to, and I understood that that wouldn't prevent me from coming to trial, but that before I went to prison, I wanted to go through that treatment program, and he said, okay. And by the grace of God, that afternoon, I was allowed to join the Genesis Drug Treatment Program, and start going to groups, and I need to tell you about the miracle of the first AA meeting that I went to, which was that night. It was at a little Genesis group, and there weren't a lot of people there, but they all found out what my name was, and they welcomed me, and it was a speakers meeting that night, and a woman spoke who had been to prison. I'd never known anybody that had been to prison before. And what she talked about was the promise, we'll not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. At that point, all I did was regret the past. You know, I was eaten alive with the guilt of things that I had done and the people that I had terribly, terribly hurt. And she looked okay. And she was happy. And all of a sudden, I knew that there was some hope for me, no matter what I had done and what I had become. I didn't have to drink anymore, and I didn't have to be miserable, and I didn't have to cry all the time. You know, I felt hope for the first time in a long, long time because of that meeting and because of those people. That's a 28-day program, and they kept me for about 90 days. I kept trying to figure out how it worked. I thought everybody else knew all the answers, and all of a sudden I didn't know any of them, you know. Um, One of the things I used to say at that point was, the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. It doesn't include smoking, swearing, and screwing around, which were some of my big problems at that time. When they let me out of the treatment center, the judge told me that he thought I was doing pretty good, and if I'd follow some rules, he might consider probation. And he gave me these rules: live like a married lady. I could tell you I didn't know what that meant, but I did. And live with a counselor. They couldn't get me into a halfway house. So I was going to live with a counselor and get a job. I didn't do any of those things. I spent my time with a man I met at the treatment center, and I found somebody else to support me, and I told everybody I had a job. You know, one of the things that seems to have happened to me since I've come into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is that I can't get away with lying too much anymore. I get caught. I used to be able to pull off bluffs like that and have them last a long time. That lasted a few weeks, and actually it lasted about 4 days, and I started getting questioned, and when I didn't change in about 2 weeks, one day I went to a group, and Bel Air Police Department was there to pick me up. Madison County wanted myself back in Madison County, so they transported me to back to jail. And I want to tell you that when the police department came to get me, there was a gentleman that said to me, "Cynthia, alcoholism is a symptom of your disease. You have some other things you're going to have to give up in your life. If you're serious about not drinking and drugging, there's some other things you're going to have to change." And he told me that wherever I was going to go, AA would be there. They don't have a cell for women in Madison County except for a drunk tank, so they took me to Walker County, which is in Huntsville. And when I got there, I told the jailer that I wanted somebody from AA to come and see me, and they came. You know, I just couldn't believe that. Those ladies came. And they put them in the cell with me to talk to me now. They didn't put them behind a screen or someplace. They brought them in the cell, and they brought a big book, and they brought a 12 and 12. And I stayed there for about 3 weeks, and those ladies kept coming. And if they couldn't come, they sent somebody else to come. You know, that's what love's all about, I think, today. I wish I knew who those ladies were to tell them what an important part they played in my sobriety. It didn't take them long to get me to trial, and I was so lucky. I know today I plea bargained for a 15-year sentence and was transported to the Maximum Security Unit for Women's Corrections in Texas, which is Mountain View. Ms. Martin said she got a form that said I wanted the program. I about drove them crazy at reception asking for a counselor to come and see me. They don't see people while they're being processed in. I wrote so many forms that late, she finally came to see me. Her name's Kathy Welch, and she's a counselor at one of the other women's units. And she came back for a couple of days. And when I got to Mountain View, they call it pull and chain. You know, when you're moved from one unit to another for assignment, we're not chained together anymore like we used to be, but they do still call it pull and chain. There were 24 of us. Mountain View Unit is mostly big-timers and women that have committed violent crimes. Most of the people that we have on our unit are doing over a 10-year sentence. I live with a number of women right now that are doing life sentences. Anyway, when I pulled chain, Ms. Martin came out into the hall, and she said that she loved me, and she didn't even know me. And she told me that there was an alcohol and drug program on our unit that included an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting on Sundays, and I could come. And I went that first Sunday. And all that same hope and love and acceptance that I had felt outside, I felt there. It was okay to be me. It was okay to be angry sometimes. It was okay to hurt and to cry and to laugh. I didn't have to pretend there in those meetings. The way that we get the message in prison is from you. On Sundays, we have an open meeting, and that's when we have our free will visitors. That's how I know what the message is, and that's how about 60 or 70 other women on a regular basis. We have a big turnover, as Bob told you, in prison. Some of us stay around longer than others, though. I think we need more help. You know, that's when you come, and that's how we know what the message is. That's how we know about how Alcoholics Anonymous works. That's our meeting, you know. During the week, we have a small group counseling session of about 10 or 12 women. That's other related kinds of counseling goes on. Sunday, it's an AA meeting. The other way that we know what the message is by materials that are sent from a lot of groups. I've seen a lot of those people that come to visit this weekend, and it has made me feel so good for somebody to know my name. And I've seen people who send us materials. Sometimes they send us materials anonymously, and we don't know who they are. The big book that I have, I recently lost my big book. I left it in Miss Martin's office, and I can't find it. And so I guess I didn't need it. I was real attached to it. I thought I could find what I wanted in it because everything was underlined. And I found out by having a new one that I can find some things that aren't underlined. The big book that I had came from a group in San Antonio. The other way that we know what the message is through tapes. We are real blessed to have tapes of some speakers and conventions. In the 4 years that I've been on the unit, almost 4 years, I feel like I've been to a lot of conventions because we have tapes of a number of them. And we're real short of tape players. That's a problem, but when we can get one in our dorm, we stay hooked up to tapes a lot. Those of us in the program. That's how we get the message in prison, you know. I heard the old-timers talk Thursday night about going to meetings and going to the people that they needed to hear in the beginning parts of their sobriety. Right now, some of us in sobriety can't do that, and we have to depend on the message being brought to us. And I feel really grateful that I get to hear that message on a regular basis. That's one of the miracles of my sobriety today. Big Book tells me that I have a daily reprieve based on the maintenance of my spiritual program. I'm real lucky that when I went to my first AA meeting, you know, God worked such miracles better than I could ever even dream possible. When I went to my first AA meeting and when I talked to those people that were in treatment, they did not tell me that for the program to work, you had to believe in God. And they didn't give me a Bible. I knew I was going to hell when I was 9 for the things that I was doing, because if you danced and you liked boys and you lied, then you were going to go to hell. And I had this picture of God who pointed his finger and knew, you know, zap, zap, zap. And I was zapped. I also knew that he had this book. I don't know why I thought he had a book, but he had a book that he wrote black marks down and gold stars. And I knew I had a lot more black marks and gold stars. I didn't want to hear that God had to work in my life. I'd have probably thrown a Bible at somebody. Luckily, they gave me a big book. And, you know, it's a few chapters before you get to We Agnostics, and they talk about the power that's the answer to our problem. By the time I got there, I had come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. For me, at first, that was a group of recovering alcoholics. I fought tooth and toenail and left scratches all over, giving up to a power greater than myself, who today I choose to call God. That's been one of the biggest struggles in my sobriety. Finding and developing a spiritual program, I thought I had to do it. I didn't know God did it for me. Today He just loves me and takes care of me and protects me. Well, another problem I had was everybody called Him Father, and I made Him into mine, and that wasn't the best wonderful relationship there'd ever been in the world. It's funny how much healing came when I discovered that. He doesn't have to be my Father, but He can be what I dream a very best friend is. That's how I maintain my spiritual program today, with meditation and prayer to my best friend. I want to thank you again for being here and for your acceptance and for this chance to talk to you and to let you know how important you are to me. And the women in the program who are my friends want me to tell you how important you are to them. Whether you come to the prison or not, if you belong to a group, you know, we feel your support and your love and your caring. And I want to thank you for them and for me for doing that, for caring about us. God bless you.
Thank you, Cynthia. Without any further ado, we have time to introduce Dan, our other speaker. We appear to be running just a little late, but you know how it goes.
Hi, everybody. My name's Tom, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Tom.
The grace of God and the fellowship of this program. Who said that? Must have been Dick S. I haven't found it necessary to consume alcohol or any other drugs since September the 18th, 1977. And for this, I'm truly grateful. It's been a blessing and a humbling and gratifying experience for me to work in the prison system. God knew what He was doing when He sent me there. And I don't know that my sobriety and my spiritual life would be today if I had not gone there. Been very rewarding as well as frustrating at times, a lot of tears, but a lot of caring and a lot of love, which I was never able to really do with even my wife and six children. And as a result of where I work today, I'm able to love them and care about them. This man is going to speak to you. God sent into my life. I've grown to love Him as I have not only the people that I work with in our program, but I've learned to care about all the other inmates on the unit, which is about 1,600 on the Ramsey 1 unit, which is located in Rocheron. And they've all been a blessing to me. They've helped me far, far greater than what I've been able to help them. And I love the things that Cynthia had to say, because you people are a great part of what goes on in the walls and behind the bars of all the prison units. I don't want to take any more Don's time. this time I'd like to welcome Don C.
Hi out there, I am Don C. I'm a recovering alcoholic. And now that we're over with all those formalities, I'd like to introduce myself. Okay? I am the male representative for TDC population. And I am grateful to the God that I understand for being right here today. I'm not real proud of a lot of reasons that put me here, but those were reasons of choice. I've learned in my sobriety that we're responsible for everything we do, although we're not always in charge of them. And the more I examine myself in my sobriety, the more I see these things. But now, I can't say that my childhood days were responsible for my irresponsibility. Because unlike a lot of people today, I was raised in the same town, had the same mother and daddy, raised in the same house, went to the same school, and had the same set of friends. And that's about as stable of a requirement as a person ought to have. But I was irresponsible. I grew up young. I can't say my parents were alcoholics, but they drank. That was the mode of relaxation at the time. Whenever we're up to about 8 years old, I've learned that our lifestyle, a lot of our thinking processes have already been developed. And in being around alcohol, that seemed like an acceptable thing to do. So, by the time I was in junior high school, my dad would go on fishing trips, and he'd say, there's a tub with ice in it full of Cokes, and there's a tub full of beer. The Cokes are for the kids, the beer are for adults. I drink soda water during the day, and when they'd go to bed at night, I'd get in a tub of beer. Of course, it didn't take but a half a can of beer at that time to get me off. This was contrary to the way I was being raised at home. At home, beer was in a refrigerator, and I'd rather you drink one here if you've got to drink one than sneak around. So I did, and I was relaxed by doing it. That went up into high school days, and I was athletically inclined. I discovered that I could drink and stay in shape. I could participate. I could date the girls when my interest got that far along. But I never picked up smoking because that affected my athletic ability. I'm not going to say I was real good at anything because I've never been real good at anything. Sort of like the expression, I'm a jack of all trades and a master of none. I have had my fingers in a lot of different things, and I can do a little bit of a lot of things, but I'm not real proficient at any one thing, but I got darn good at drinking. I really did. I got off into that because Tom T. Hall says I like beer, and I did. I like my memory today still enjoys the thoughts of what I did, and I remember the pleasures of what I did. I don't always like the consequences that followed. I had a scholarship offered me coming out of high school, and in my senior year, well, between my junior and senior year, I had my first full-time job earning a man's wages, doing a man's work, cutting brush with machete all day long. And I liked that. That was attractive to me. I went back to high school for a few weeks, and I quit school. I was going to school half a day my senior year, but I liked the money. and I wasn't concerned about school. I wasn't responsible in my actions to myself. I grew up, maybe as a product of my time, I had the philosophy that you can't cry over spilt milk. I don't care if syrup goes up to 95 cents a sop. And as Farron Young said, I'm going to live fast, love hard, and die young, and leave a beautiful memory. And I still, in a lot of ways, don't worry about spilt milk and don't care if syrup goes up 95 cents a sop. The other part of it, I don't think of too much anymore. But because of quitting school and going into a man's world, I knocked around for a few years and worked in Houston. I grew up in a small town called Huntsville, Texas. And built a lot of friends because I had a good enough personality to where I could BS my way to just about anything I wanted. And that worked because of my ingrained selfishness. If I got what I wanted, it didn't matter what I had to do to get it. My morals weren't real high at an early age. I stole. I would want to go to a theater on a weekend, so I'd walk to town. I lived 3 or 4 miles out of town. We'd walk to town, go to a grocery store, steal the soda water bottles off the back loading ramp, go through the front door and sell them back to the people. I see some people shaking their heads out there. Yeah, you know what it is. That was an acceptable thing. People of that time, you worked all week long. You figured you owed yourself a little partying on the weekends. Blow off some steam. Get in a good Friday or Saturday night fight. The whole beer joint. Back then when they had bands, they had chicken wire in front of the stages, because when a beer joint broke out in a fight, let me tell you, it's every man for himself. And that was the acceptable thing to do. I was raised in a country. We'd get through having a good old Saturday night fight. I'd sit down. We'd drink beer together. We weren't mad. There wasn't any guns. Wasn't any knives. It was just the thing to do. It seemed a good idea at the time. Steve McQueen talked about in one of his movies, there was a man stepped up on his horse, on his saddle, dove off naked into a big pile of cactus, and they asked him why he did it, and he said, well, it seemed like a good idea at the time. You know, but boy, the results of it was terrible. I joined the service. I grew up drinking, and all these things were acceptable to me. I joined the service, went in the Marine Corps, went to Vietnam. Drinking was my mode of relaxation. When I got to the NOMS, I was turned on to the drugs that were over in Orient. This country boy had never smoked a joint of grass. A six-pack of beer, case of beer, whatever, was my high. But I found a better high, a quicker high, and I went to it because it was there. Man, you over in the NOMS, when I was over there, you could buy a cigarette package of ready-rolled marijuana cigarettes for 20 cents a piece. 20 cents a pack, excuse me. They were a penny a piece. This day and time, that's unbelievable, but that's the way it was. It grew wild out there like Johnson grass grows here. I got into a lot of scrapes. Uncle Sam taught me real well self-defense. It was a matter of survival. And one day, I was in the brush. 10 hours later, I was in San Francisco, California, getting ready to discharge. And I didn't know didn't have any idea at the time the traumatic experience that was going to play on me. I'm directing this little talk toward those of you who are vets to let you know what I went through and where I am now. I've always worked. I've always had a full-time job. I was married when I went overseas. I raised a family. I was married for 12 years until my wife passed away. But I stole. I burglarized. I'd break into camp houses, weekend houses. If I saw a deer rifle in the back window of a truck in front of a beer joint, that was fair game. But it wasn't the stealing I have found that was the motivation. It was the adrenaline rush of doing it. And this stems back to my Vietnam experiences. As a young man is prime material to be a soldier because he's moldable. You can teach him to do and think and react, and he won't think a second thought about it. He'll do it. But if you don't deprogram him, he doesn't know how to undo it. And this is one reason that so many Vietnam vets have had social and psychological problems in these last 10-15 years, is because they didn't know how to deprogram. And whenever I came into this penitentiary, when I committed this felony, I had an opportunity to meet an active vet counselor. While I was still in the county jail, I went to the college there, Sam Houston Teachers College, Sam Houston State now. And I learned a lot of things about me, a lot of things that about resentments, about seclusion, about being a loner, not identifying, anger, emotional outbursts that were over a little bit of nothing, but 6 months of stored up emotion came out. If somebody got in my face and tripped my trigger, the fight wouldn't be about what was going down then. It would be about that and 6 months of the garbage that I have put in behind it. And it's just been building and building. I didn't know how to relate to people. I didn't know how to explain things like this. But I began understanding through Vietnam vet stress counseling. I still have the same problems. I don't think the problems will ever go away. But what they have done is made me aware of seeing them coming to me. Where once I stood right here and let them hit me in the face, I can see them coming, step over to the side, and let them keep on trucking. They don't bother me anymore like that. When I got out of Vietnam, got out of the Marine Corps, I went to work. I always drank. And now I knew about drugs. I went to work out of Houston. That's the closest big city. Worked on tugboats. I liked moving around. I have never been satisfied in an indoor job because my feet always itched. I always had to scratch them on the road moving around. And I found out that I don't work and drink. I don't work and drug. But if I got a job where I was 7 days working and 7 days off, boy, I could party hardy for those 6 days that I was off. I could party continuously. And then the last day before I had to go back to work, I'd sober up. Well, you know, at least I wouldn't be so sick. I could go to work and I could do my job. And that's the way my lifestyle developed. I came to the penitentiary. And first time, this is my second time to come to the penitentiary. I came to the penitentiary in 70, behind stealing, behind burglary of business. Again, I'm working full time, don't need the money, but it's the adrenaline rush, the challenge of being able to do it and being able to get over on somebody. This was real satisfying to me. I went into the AA program there. I went to church. I went to college because they gave incentive points that would help you get out early. I didn't go for any of the right reasons. I went for Don, for the selfish reasons, because that was the acceptable thing to do, and that would help me get out sooner. And I sat in on all the AA meetings. I went to group counseling because that's part of playing the game. I learned a lot of things, but I didn't apply any of them. One of the things that I learned was there are several different types of drunks or categories, and I am, as best I can figure, a periodic drunk. I could work for a week or a month, and as long as I'm working, I don't drink on the job. That's my personal discipline. Discipline's a strong thing you learn in service, more especially the Marine Corps. I didn't drink, but my days off was my time, and when I paid the bills, I put the bill money in a hat, and the rest of it was mine, and I deserved a party. I told my wife I'd give her whatever she needed, whatever she told me she needed, I'd give it to her. But then the rest of it was mine. I would include her in my partying if it fit my pleasure. If I wanted to go off by myself, it didn't matter how much she wanted to go, she'd stay at the house. With many arguments about that. I tell you what, she's not living now. But
just a miracle of injecting the power, the only thing that can keep us sober. It's got to be a power greater than we are. So these miracles that happened to Bill, that he could reveal in writing these 12 steps as we stay sober with him today, to me is a miracle of God. The next miracle to me is that when Bill went to Akron with a little old stock deal to try to make a buck to feed Lois, he and Lois, and the deal fell through, like many of us had deals fall through, and then we were going to get drunk at it. So him to walk for Bill to come down the elevator in the old Mayflower Hotel and walk over to where there's a directory of 40 churches, at least 40, and Bill goes and picks out because he needed to talk to somebody that could help him get in touch with another drunk that might be able to help him. And out of the 40 ministers on all those churches, he picked out the one who would call Henrietta Saberling and call Dr. Bob, and they would meet at the beginning of AA. Now, isn't that a miracle? It couldn't be anything but God looking down and having charge of that thing, the situation. So, the miracles that I have observed along in AA in my 41 years in it, was one day in 1950. I had met Bill in 1946, the latter part of 46. He and Lois came to Amarillo, and I met them at the plane there, and I'd never seen him. And a little lady in AA here went with me, and she said, "How are you going to know Bill? Have you ever seen him?" I said, "No." "How are you going to know him?" I said, "Well, he's a drunk, and I'm a drunk. And I know a drunk when I see a drunk." "Well," she said, "I don't think you can." So he came off the plane, and people streams of them coming off the plane. And on, and here came a guy off with an old black hat on that he slept in. The back was mashed in where he'd been sleeping in the hat, his shirt tail out. And here he comes off the thing, and long, slim guy walking down. And I said, "That's him." He said, "No, that couldn't be him or his wife. Where's Lois?" I said, "She's about 25 feet behind. That's the Al-Anon way back there." Gotta be Bill. Gotta be the drunk. On the plane from there on to Lubbock, Bill reached in his pocket and he said, "I want you to look at this. We're taking this to the grassroots of the old ones around in AA and see what you think about it." Written out in longhand was the 12 traditions of AA, just exactly the way they are now. Exactly. Not a word different. And I said, "Well, Bill, I don't see that. Why do we need it?" He said, "We had an Oxford movement, didn't we? We had a lot of movement. We had a lot of things. Did they work?" "They worked for a while, but we didn't keep it." "Why?" "We didn't have any traditions." "So we know this works, so let's make sure we're going to keep it. I don't want to ever lose it." So we have kept that faith with the 12 traditions, with the 12 steps, the first legacy. We have kept the second legacy, that of the 12 traditions. And then, to me, this miracle on a day in 1950, right here at the old Melrose Hotel, we were sitting there, and like Bill and I, we were talking about, you want to know how these things happen and how they work. And I asked Bill pointedly, I said, "Bill, what would you rather see happen? Now we've gone from 1935 to its 50 now. What would you rather see happen in AA than anything that's ever happened up until this date?" He didn't study but a second, and he said, "I'd rather see Abby have a chance to get sober. I want to show you the miracle of AA. You'll see, Abby was still drunk on the Bower. The guy that Abby that came to Bill in the town hospital and said, this is, Bill said, oh, that's religion. But how could he fuss with it? It's working." So we injected, he did, into our program some of the things from the old Oxford movement that Abby had found. But the miracle that was in Bill's heart to help to pass it on, to give it to somebody else. And he said, "Abby's never had a chance to get sober. He's full of pity, remorse, anger. Anyhow, Abby came, as you know, we said, put him on, bring him down here." We brought him down here, and he went in the clinic, the old clinic that I had down there, and he got sober and died sober, 2 years sober. So was this a miracle of God? Bill passed it on to Abby? That's the working. That's the way it worked. That worked. And that's the way it still works. I would like to say that when Bob gave me the big book and the little pamphlet and told me to try to go to meetings at least once a month, to do something different than what you've been doing, to try to better yourself, in hiding this big book from my wife, because, you know, I didn't want her to think I had a bad drinking problem. You know, I'd only been drunk 30 years, so why, you know. But anyhow, she didn't say a word about it, about the big book, having read it, but she understood how AA worked. She could see the workings of AA in the big book. She's here tonight, and we've been together 52 years. I want her to stand up there. So, along with that, none of us would be here without the Al-Anons and your help and your understanding. Will all the Al-Anons stand, all the Al-Anons and loved ones, stand up, will you, please? All of them. I can only say that, and I think I speak for all of these old guys up here with me tonight, that if there's one word that binds us together in this great fellowship is the word gratitude. If we're grateful enough for what's happened, if we're grateful enough for AA, the thing that saved our lives, and the thing that gives us so much joy, then we will do whatever is necessary to pass it on to somebody else. To give it away, we'll have it left. If we keep it, somebody's got to die. So, somebody said, be careful what you do. Be careful what you say. Be careful what you are. You may be the only Bible somebody will have to read. Thank you, and God bless you, and good night.
Say something else I forgot to tell you. One of the greatest things that happened in my life, I got to make amends to all my folks before they passed away. They'd been to my birthday, and they knew that I was on the right road. And I'm so grateful for that. Money or anything else couldn't buy that, because I've seen a lot of people that their mother or sister or brother, their wives had passed away, and they wasn't, you couldn't find them. And I was that way. But through the grace of God and AA, it didn't happen to me. Thank you.
On behalf of all of the people here, I want to thank each of you for keeping the faith. We sure did need what you had going when we got here, and I trust that we'll all do the same. If those of you who would care to, if you'll stand and join me in the Lord's Prayer, we'll close. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread,